You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, but I am not, of course, Tom Hartman. I'm David Sirota filling in for Tom Hartman. I'm the morning host here on AM 760 in Colorado. You can find out more about me, sirota.am760.net, or at my own website, davidsirota.com. I'm a syndicated newspaper columnist, writer for salon.com, also an author of a number of books. We got a bunch of things coming up for you today, a very busy show. In this first hour, we're going to be talking about tax cuts. Yes, they're back. They're back on the agenda. We are still talking about tax cuts 11 years after George W. Bush successfully passed his tax cuts through Congress. What is new? What is being debated? And why is Bill Clinton part of the discussion, seemingly, on George W. Bush's side? That's coming up in just a minute. Coming up towards the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the big court case of the moment, the Jerry Sandusky case at Penn State. Will he get a fair trial, or will the jury be stacked in his favor? A number of jurors having connections to Penn State. Of course, the Sandusky case out of Penn State. It's about child sexual molestation, but a whole lot more. How institutions, especially big money institutions in college and in sports, protect themselves. Will he be able to get a fair trial? Will justice be able to be served with so many Penn Staters on that jury? And coming up in the next hour, at the top of the next hour, our second hour, we're going to be talking to a reporter with the Washington Examiner who broke a pretty big story that went largely unnoticed. A story of emails from the White House, between the White House and the drug industry. What did the president know, and when did he know it? And why was he telling the public something very different about what the health care bill would do? But as I said, we're going to start with a discussion of tax cuts. They are back. They are back in a big way. The Bush tax cuts set to expire, all of the tax cuts set to expire at the end of the year. The question already being debated is whether they should end at the end of the year. Bill Clinton put this back on the agenda. In an interview this week with CNBC, the former president, the guy who, during a recession, raised taxes on the wealthy, let's not forget that, he gave an interview to CNBC saying the Bush tax cuts, including the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy, should be at least temporarily extended. Here is the clip from CNBC. The beginning of it is the key point where he is asked, are you saying you think the Bush tax cuts, all of the Bush tax cuts, should be extended? Here's what he said.
I think it will.
Wrong clip. Here's the clip.
I don't have any problem with extending all of it now, including the current spending levels. They're still pretty low, the government spending levels. They look high because there's a recession, so the taxes look lower than they really would be if we had 2.5-3% growth, and the spending is higher than it would be if we had 2.5-3% growth because there are so many people getting food stamps, so many people getting unemployment.
And the Republicans have taken the first part of that statement where he says, I think they should, everything should be extended at least for the foreseeable future, and said this is an endorsement, Bill Clinton endorsing at least a temporary extension of the Bush tax cuts. Now, Clinton went on to say, I don't think we should permanently extend the Bush tax cuts, but his argument is that the economy is in such dire straits right now that we can't do anything to rock the boat. This argument sound familiar? Yeah, it should. Remember Barack Obama, who promised to end the Bush tax cuts? When he signed on to a temporary extension of the Bush tax cuts, he said, well, in the future, I want to get rid of the Bush tax cuts, but the economy is so fragile, we can't get rid of the Bush tax cuts. I feel like this is going to be every 2 years for the rest of my life. I mean, I'm 36 years old, so hopefully I've got some more years ahead of me. But I feel like for the foreseeable future, every 2, every 4 years, some politician, whether a Republican or a Democrat, is going to say, well, you know, we want to get rid of the tax cuts. We really should. And we've got this thing called the national debt and the national deficit out there, but we got to extend them just a little more, just for a little while longer. We can't touch anything right now. There's always a reason not to take away a giveaway to the super wealthy, isn't there? And it's always that reason, because the politicians speaking largely have their campaigns financed by the people who benefit from the Bush tax cuts. Now, Another person has been making news on this same score. This is why it's become a big issue today. Larry Summers, the former hedge funder, former top economic advisor to President Obama, also seeming to suggest that we should at least temporarily extend all of the Bush tax cuts, including the tax cuts to the wealthiest 1%, those making over $250,000 a year. He said, quote, that we can't essentially rock the boat right now. That we can't, we don't want to take fuel out of the engine of the economy. That Larry Summers basically saying that while he understands, and the quote here is, he understands that the people who've gotten the most gains from the economy over the last 30 years are the people who've also gotten the biggest tax reductions, that while he understands that, we don't want to take fuel out of the economy. That anything that takes stimulus out of the economy is a bad idea right now. Now, this comes out on the same day, of course, that the Congressional Budget Office chief issued a report saying that the stimulus, the spending side of what's happened in the last few years, has significantly helped the economy, that 80% of economists on both the right and left agree that the stimulus helped the economy. So I want to throw it to you and ask you this question. Do you think the Bush tax cuts should be extended? Do you think the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy should be extended, people making over $250,000 a year, temporarily? Obviously, the Republicans say they should be extended permanently. 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466 if you want to weigh in on that. Or if you're a conservative, you can call our conservative line, 866-745-2667. Do you think Bill Clinton is right, that and Larry Summers is right, that we don't want to do anything, don't want to take any fiscal stimulus, whether the tax cut side or the spending side, out of the economy right now, that the economy is just too tenuous? Or are you like me, somebody who says, listen, last I checked, Bill Clinton raised taxes in the middle of a recession, and when he raised taxes on the wealthy in the middle of a recession, it helped spark an economic boom. Now, you may be thinking, well, Sirota, why would that help spark an economic boom? Well, because you raise marginal tax rates, and here's what really happens. And I know Tom Hartman says this often, and it's worth remembering. We are led to believe in our politics that you cut marginal income tax rates and supposedly the economy grows, when in fact George Bush enacted the biggest marginal income tax rate cuts in contemporary American history, and the decade that he was in power was the decade of the slowest economic growth in contemporary American history. The reason why the economy does well when marginal tax rates are a bit higher is because when marginal tax rates, income tax rates, are a bit higher, it incentivizes business owners to keep their funds in their business. If I can pull my money out of my business at a low marginal tax rate and pay only a little bit in income taxes, that's an incentive for me to pull my money out of my business. If marginal tax rates are a bit higher, at the end of the year, I see my business, I say, you know what, I'm not going to pull all my money out of my business. I'm going to reinvest it in the business, take the tax write-off, because if I pull it out of my business, I'm going to face a marginally higher tax rate. That's exactly why higher marginal tax rates than we've had have spurred, or have at least helped spur, economic booms. I don't buy the idea that if we get rid of tax cuts for people making over a quarter mil a year, it's going to hurt the economy. I think it encourages them to keep their money in the game, to keep their money in their business, to keep their money in the economy, investing in the economy. Coming up next, speaking of the super rich, a new report out, the number of wealthy households paying no income taxes spiked after 2004. What does that mean for this debate? Really shocking graph there. And we'll get to your calls about whether you agree with Bill Clinton that we should extend all of the Bush tax cuts. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And remember, later on in this hour, we're going to be talking about the Jerry Sandusky case at Penn State. Can he get a fair trial? Stick around for that as well.
I don't have any problem with extending all of it now,
That was, of course, Bill Clinton insisting that we should at least temporarily extend the Bush tax cuts and not rock the boat in the economy. Larry Summers, President Obama's former top economic advisor, making similar comments. Do you agree or disagree? I'm David Sirota filling in here for Tom Hartman. If you want to weigh in on the conversation, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Or if you're a conservative, 866-745-2667. Before we get to the phones, one piece of relevant news to our discussion about taxes. According to data from the IRS today, 1 in 189 high-income Americans paid no federal income taxes at all in 2009. This included households making more than $200 million. That's right, $200 million.
We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
Okay, maybe not $100 billion, but $200 million and not paying any taxes. A new chart over at Think Progress notes that the number of wealthy taxpayers managing to avoid entirely the income tax spiked in a big way after 2004. It increased eightfold after 2004. Boy, and we wonder why we're in such fiscal dire straits. Let's go to the phone, see if you agree with Bill Clinton, who says we should extend all of the Bush tax cuts, at least temporarily, at the end of this year, or whether you agree with President Obama, whose White House spokesperson said that the Obama administration has no plans to support any more temporary extensions. Where do you come down in this debate? We will start with Joe in New Jersey, listening in on Sirius XM Radio. Joe, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hey, thanks, David, for taking the call. I agree with the White House spokesperson who says we should not extend those cuts. And I think that Bill Clinton was making a more nuanced argument than what, you know, is commonly thought in the media. What I think he was saying is, because of this partisan gridlock, we're not going to be able to get anything done. It's just going to have to sit to the side until these elections are finished and then wipe them out.
But here's my problem.
I think President Obama, who's doing a fantastic job, in my opinion, I think his biggest problem is his surrogates and his advocates are so blah. I watch them on TV, on the talk shows, and they're so damn boring. Even if they're making a good point, they just have no energy, no passion.
But here's the issue.
You can't get people to listen to your argument.
The issue is this, though.
That
Obama doesn't have to do much of anything to get these tax cuts off the books. See, we are in a situation where if the Congress does nothing, if gridlock ensues, we can actually get a policy victory. And what I mean by that is, if the Congress doesn't act at the end of this year, all of the Bush tax cuts expire. Now, some may say, well, that wouldn't be such a good thing because some of the tax cuts for middle-income folks would expire as well. But the lion's share of the Bush tax cuts were tax cuts for the super wealthy. That's just math speaking. And so we are finally in a position now where congressional gridlock can actually achieve a progressive end. That if the Congress does nothing, or if the president uses his veto pen, the Bush tax cuts, which delivered the worst economy in the last few decades, tax cuts that did not spur job growth, if the Congress does nothing, they're gone. So my take is, Bill Clinton, the gridlock that you're talking about, the partisanship in Congress, for once, it actually could work to achieve a progressive victory, to achieve a more equitable tax policy. And the thing that's perplexing about Bill Clinton saying this is, you kind of wonder if Bill Clinton today, the 2012 Bill Clinton, would have criticized the Bill Clinton of 1992 who raised taxes in the middle of a recession. Look, I remember that. I was a kid. I was ready to go to college. I was in 10th grade. I was starting to think about college. And I remember Bill Clinton pushing those taxes. I actually lived in the district of the congresswoman who cast the key vote for those tax increases, Congresswoman Marjorie Margolis-Mezvinsky, who was summarily booted out of Congress after one term precisely because of that vote. And I thought it was the right vote then, and I think it would be the right vote now. And so you kind of wonder, what's up with Bill Clinton? Well, why is he saying this? Could it be that the guy's made $80 million in his post-presidency, oftentimes through speeches and work with some of the richest and most powerful people in this country, and he's grown accustomed to once again speaking for them? He didn't always speak for them, although at some points in his White House presidency, certainly with deregulation, he did. But you kind of wonder whether he, as a one percenter, is speaking for the 1%. But, Joe, I'm with you. I think President Obama's got it right, and I hope he sticks to his pledge to finally get rid of some of the worst tax policies we've seen ever on the books in recent American history. We will go to Maggie calling in from Portland, Oregon. Maggie, you're on the Tom Hartman program. You think Bill Clinton is right or Barack Obama?
I think Barack Obama's right, and I'm really thrilled to talk to you, Mrs. Sirota.
Well, I'm thrilled to talk to you. Thanks for calling
amazing.
In.
But I think that Bill Clinton is wrong. And are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I think that Bill Clinton was wrong. I think he was wrong back when NAFTA happened. I think he's wrong again. I don't see any... I mean, the country's tanked since we've been handing out these tax cuts. And, you know, as a middle-class person, you know, those tax cuts, we're not seeing them. They keep telling us that we're getting all these great tax cuts, but I can only assume that they aren't coming to us. They're only going to
the 1%. Well, that's right.
And as you said, the 1% shouldn't be talking for the middle class.
There is absolutely, in my estimation, no reason to extend these tax cuts. That, again, if you look back on recent American history suggests that when you are in a recession, it doesn't necessarily have to be a time where you say we're not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. In fact, Bill Clinton's history suggests that getting rid of tax cuts, in that case the Reagan tax cuts, on the wealthy in the middle of a recession is the way to actually incentivize the wealthy to put money back into the economy rather than take it out as pure profit. Maggie, thanks for your call. Coming up next, the Sandusky case. Can he get a fair trial? Is it even possible? Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If the jury is stacked with Penn Staters, can they really judge a fellow Penn Stater? We're going to break it down coming up next. Stick around. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm David Sirota filling in for Tom Hartman, and I've been hearing that song, well, since as long as I can remember, when I was going to summer camp. Is it Sirota or my Sharona? Or, well, there were other things I was called, of course. But my son Isaac, he just came here. He was here just a little while ago with my wife. He's 18 months old, and at some point I have to let him know people are going to be singing that song to him and kind of razzing him with it, probably for the rest of his life. I guess I have to apologize to him for that. He was here for lunch before we started the broadcast here. We're going to move on to a big story in the sports world, but it's also in the criminal justice world. The headline, Jerry Sandusky jury filled with Penn Staters. Whether it will help or hurt his cause is already up for debate, but this much is sure. Jerry Sandusky's fate, the former coach of the Penn State football program, defensive coordinator, his fate will be decided by a group of people with lots of ties to Penn State, according to USA Today. Among the 12 main jurors selected for Sandusky's sex abuse trial are a school senior, an engineering administrative assistant, a dance teacher, and a professor who's been on the faculty for nearly a quarter century. By its count, seven of the 12 and two of the four alternates are connected to the school in some ways. One trial expert saying, quote, it's not a jury of this man's peers, as we generally refer to juries. It's like a jury of your coworkers. So many have a connection to this man's workplace. The jury was seated in unusually fast fashion, and opening arguments are scheduled to begin on Monday. The question in this case is whether this guy will get a fair trial or whether the jury will be unduly tilted towards protecting the institution. That's what this story is really all about. This is not really a sports story. It's a story about what happens when the institution becomes more important than the individuals. And that kind of flips the paradigm on its head. Usually in our politics, especially on the Republican side, there's this effort to always blame individuals rather than asking questions about systems. Oh, somebody's poor? Get a job. Herman Cain, he blamed people for being unemployed. It's your fault for being, it's the individual's fault. It's not the economic system's fault, an economic system that has been laying people off and outsourcing jobs systemically. Same thing here with the Penn State situation, but in reverse. In this case, the institution of Penn State, and an even larger institution, big money college football, seemed to take precedence for years over the lives of individuals, the potentially ruined lives of individuals. Now, we don't know who's guilty or innocent yet, but that's really the question here. And the town that the college is in is one of those towns that's really a one-company town. It's kind of out of a past era. I think of Butte, Montana. I used to live up in Montana. I used to live in Helena, Montana. And Butte, Montana was a place for 100 years in the late 1800s to about the mid-1900s. For about 100 years was this one-company town, Anaconda Copper. And that company controlled everything. Everybody either worked for the company or was related to people who worked for the company. It's the same thing with State College in Pennsylvania. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. Everybody knew State College is organized around Penn State. And so the integrity, the image of that institution becomes far more important than any of the individuals. So let me throw it to you on this question. Do you think the jury, a jury in which 7 of the 12 jurors are connected to the institution who's really in question here, do you think they're going to throw this case? Do you think that this case is going to be a sham? Do you think Jerry Sandusky is going to get a fair trial? Or do you think that the question of the institution will be too much on the minds of the jury, which is so connected to the institution, that truly is the one being indicted here? I mean, Jerry Sandusky is being charged with crimes, sexual molestation, but in the process, so is the institution. And again, not just of Penn State, but of college football, big-time college football. Do you know how much money there is at risk here? If Jerry Sandusky is found guilty, do you know how much money is potentially at risk in NCAA sports with a football program like Penn State? 866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM, if you want to weigh in on this. 866-745-2667 if you're a conservative. Again, 866-745-2667. Will he be able to get a fair trial? Can you get a fair trial in a one-company town? Let's go to the phones, see what you think. And we'll try to mix in some other calls as well about the tax cut question, too, the first question that we asked in this hour. But let's get a call in here about Jerry Sandusky. We will go to Travis, calling in from Washington, D.C. Travis, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hey, how's it going, boss?
All right,
hey,
man.
I just want to make an add-on real quick. I don't know if this may sound legitimate or not, but about the trial, could it also be a possibility that the gentleman who sexually abused these children at Penn State, that the jurors that are from the same location actually might hurt him because they might view him as a arbiter who harmed their reputation of their school. They might actually be harder on him.
It's absolutely possible. I think that's an absolutely possible situation. And I think that this speaks to the idea that it might have been smarter to pull the entire case out of a place like State College and bring it to a neutral location where this guy really could have gotten a fair trial. Now, of course, what happens when that's proposed, right, is that depending on the views of his lawyers might say, this isn't fair. This is not a jury of his peers. That if defendants are due a jury of their peers, pulling a defendant out of a situation, out of a town, a one-company town, may not give him that due process. But look, I agree with you. I think it could go either way. It's certainly, and then the question is, well, if those jurors who are connected to Penn State want to punish this guy, and they think punishing him harshly, whether he deserves it or not, whether that skews their thinking in order to protect the university, then that raises the question, can he get a fair trial? It's a very good point. Travis, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Let's go to Bud, who is calling in from State College. Bud, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
All right. Thank you. Center County, Pennsylvania, where the jury was chosen from, is much more than just Penn State.
Well, it certainly is much more than Penn State, but you got 7 jurors who, out of the 12, who are connected directly to the institution.
And I regret that. I really do. I would have liked to have the jury totally not connected with Penn State for the possible thought that you already have of the conflict of interest.
Yeah, and, right? and the thing is, though, I mean, look, here's the thing. I've been to State College. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. You know, I mean, Penn State, it's an institution that, I mean, it's not just State College. I mean, you could argue that it's Greater Pennsylvania. I mean, it is one of the shining jewels of Pennsylvania. If people are directly connected to that institution, it could skew their views of this either way. And so I just am worried that justice, frankly, isn't going to be served and can't be served. Do you think it's going to be served?
I would hope so. I really would. But just at the beginning of what you had to say about this, as you led into the story, you called Mr. Sandusky the coach at Penn State. He was a defensive coordinator.
Yeah, he was one of the coaches. That's
Joe
right.
Joe Paterno is the only coach we talk about Penn State.
And fair enough. As somebody who grew up outside of Philadelphia, you're right. I should, because Joe Paterno just went. And, by the way, Joe Paterno just went as the name coach. All you had to say anywhere in Pennsylvania, you say coach, and it means Joe Paterno. What I meant to say is Sandusky was one of the other coaches. There were other coaches, but, of course, Joe Paterno was capital C coach. And that's a good point, Bud. Thanks for chiding me on that. Peter, calling in from Chicago, Illinois. Peter, will Sandusky get a fair trial with 7 of the 12 jurors connected to Penn State?
Depends on what you mean by a fair trial. I think he's going to walk. I think it's a setup. They're going through the motions of putting him on trial. No prosecutor would have ever let a jury be seated with that many people connected to the university if they didn't already plan on letting him walk.
Well, and you know the history of this, right? The history of this is that the charges were not brought by a previous prosecutor, that there were allegations made about this for years beforehand, and the prosecution didn't happen. Joe Paterno was informed about this and didn't go straight to the police about this. So you may end up being right. That in fact, if you look at the trajectory of this case, of what was brought to officials at the university, what was brought to officials in the criminal justice system, and how what was brought to them was basically ignored for years. If you just went on the trend line alone, you would say this guy's going to walk, whether he's innocent or guilty.
You made the point before about how much money is involved. I don't really think the prosecutor's heart is in it. I think he's forced to go through with this because of the publicity, so they're going to go through the motions so they can say that there was a trial, and he's going to get off, and they're going to say, well, we lost. But if this was a legitimate trial, the prosecutor would never have allowed this type of a jury to be seated because it's already, I think it's predetermined, he's going to walk.
Well, and you know, there's the process, and I'm not a lawyer, but there's the process of voir dire, which is each side gets to have some input about who's on the jury. And you know what? You raise a good point. Why would a prosecutor that wants to put somebody away, who believes in the case, what their position is supposed to be, why would they be comfortable with a jury in which so many people were connected to the institution that is essentially on trial? I think that's a very, very fair point. We'll squeeze a couple more calls on this question. Also coming up next, news of a massive lawsuit against the NFL. Tell you about that. And we'll take a couple more calls about the tax cut issue and Bill Clinton. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
A big lawsuit against the NFL for concussions. What does it mean, not just for the NFL, but for the state of labor relations in America? Stick around. Players file lawsuit against league on concussion. This is the headline at ABC News. More than 2,000 former NFL players plan to file a lawsuit in Philadelphia accusing the National Football League of concealing information linking football-related injuries to long-term brain damage. This is the biggest sports lawsuit ever. The former players allege that the NFL exacerbated the health risk by promoting the game's violence and deliberately and fraudulently misleading players about the link between concussions and long-term brain injuries. This is one of those stories like the Sandusky story, not just about sports. This is about fairness. This is about people going up against establishment power. This is not just a fight between millionaires and billionaires. This epitomizes the larger battle between employers and employees. And I think that as much as it's easy to write it off and say, oh, it's wealthy NFL players, millionaires versus billionaires. No, this epitomizes what all of the fights over the economy in recent years have been all about. The fight in Wisconsin, the fight on factory floors, and the fight in the NFL. Can workers, do workers have the tools available to them to say that the workplace has to be a safe workplace and the employer has to be an honest employer? This is a hugely important case, and I think we should all follow it. And I, for one, hope the players make sure that justice is served. We're talking about justice being served. If you want to weigh in on the question of the Sandusky trial, Jerry Sandusky, the Penn State defensive coordinator, now on trial over child molestation charges. 7 of the 12 jurors connected to Penn State. Can he get a fair trial, or will the trial be too fair to him, too forgiving of him? If you want to weigh in on that question, the number here, 866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM, or if you're a conservative, 866-745-2667. Also, if you want to weigh in on Bill Clinton saying that he thinks that all of the Bush tax cuts should be at least temporarily extended, I can take a couple calls on that. I'm David Sirota filling in for Tom Hartman. We will go back to the phones and see what you think on both of these subjects. Let's go to Don, calling in from Rockford, Illinois, wants to weigh in on the Sandusky situation. Don, you're on the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just want to let you guys know that Tom Hartman is my brain food of the day. I love Big Eddie. Because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat,
mm-hmm.
but Tom Hartman is just so cerebral, and you do an excellent job with your soft-spoken, well-mannered.
Thank you.
You're a great replacement for him when he's gone. My point is, I do have just a little bit of criticism for you. You're asking if he's going to get a fair trial. Let's not ask that question. Let's ask if the victims are going to get justice.
And that is the question. That's right.
Yes.
Will there be justice in this case?
I know that, but you know, it just seemed a little.
No, it's a different frame. You're absolutely right. Although I'll push back on you a little bit and say this: I think whether it's justice for victims or exoneration for Jerry Sandusky, because we have to the presumption of innocence still should be out there. We want justice to be served. And if Jerry Sandusky, we need to find out whether Jerry Sandusky really did what he did. That's part of what our court system is supposed to do. Expose the truth and then justice for the truth. And I think it's highly in question whether justice can
exactly.
be served on either score. Do you agree? Do you think the
yes,
concerns
I do.
Are legitimate?
I agree 100%. I mean, if you have a jury that most of the members are part of the organization or rely on the organization, that is as idiotic as Justice Thomas having a say on the healthcare issue when his wife makes millions of dollars
mm-hmm.
trying to shut
mm-hmm.
it down.
There's the old idea of omerta. Omerta is the code of silence in the mafia, and omerta is an idea that infuses so many institutions. Don't speak out against the family. Don't speak out against the institution if you have a vested interest in the institution. And omerta, in many cases, is the enemy of justice. Don, thanks for the call. Thanks for the kind words. Let's go to Julie, calling in from Manhattan, who wants to weigh in on Bill Clinton and the tax cuts. Julie, should the Bush tax cuts be extended even temporarily, as Bill Clinton argues?
I say no way. This is because if we extend, for instance, or give the middle class tax cut as a permanent one, you know, that's fine. But to give Bush tax cut to the rich, which in fact tax cut is 6 years low, and due to that in the bailout, the rich has gotten richer, and they have over $2 trillion cash balance lying around, and they don't want to invest it. And it is really a crime to give them tax cut at this time, because Clinton is, you know, he is with the rich, with the 1%, and he has a CGI, Clinton Global Initiatives. And it's the rich people, and it's the rich leaders who contribute money.
Well, and I think it's a fair point. I know some Democrats won't like hearing this, but I think you always have to ask, When people are speaking, who are they speaking for? Bill Clinton did some good things when he was president, but Bill Clinton is certainly part of the not just the 1%, but the 1% of the 1%, and he speaks for them. And so when he says extend the Bush tax cuts, or when previously he praised Mitt Romney's business career, I think it's fair to ask, who is he really speaking for? Thanks for your call. Let's take one more call very quickly. Nancy in Oregon. Nancy, you got about 45 seconds. You want to weigh in on the Sandusky case. Go ahead.
Yes, I live in Oregon now, but I'm a former state college resident. I still have relatives that live back there. And I know from talking to people here and talking to people there, there's a real disconnect. The people that still live in state college that have all their ties to Penn State, they're outraged. But they're outraged at the reaction. They're outraged at the ding to Joe Paterno's reputation, to the college's reputation. They don't understand. Now that I'm living in another state, everybody else, their reaction here is outrage over the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
it's a total
disconnect. And that's
disconnect.
The difference. And that's what's scary about a jury that is mostly Penn State people, a jury that may be more interested and more outraged at the tarnishing of the image than the alleged crime itself. You put it exactly right. Thanks so much for your call. Coming up next, disclosures of emails between the Obama administration and the drug industry, which seem to suggest the president was perpetuating a bait and switch on America. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to the Tom Hartman Program, but by the sound of my voice, I'm guessing you can tell I'm not Tom Hartman. I'm David Sirota filling in for Tom Hartman. You can find out more about me. DavidSirota.com is my website. I'm a syndicated newspaper columnist, a contributor to Salon.com, an author, also the host of the morning show here in the great state of Colorado in the great city of Denver on AM 760. You can find out about my radio show, my morning radio show, Sirota.am760.net. I'm a longtime friend of Tom Hartman through our mutual work together. And we're going to turn now to a question, to a story that is sad that it's not bigger news. I'm glad it was reported, but it's just a telling commentary that it wasn't bigger news this week. Joining us now is the senior political columnist for the Washington Examiner, Tim Carney, who uncovered emails from within the pharmaceutical industry and its lobbying arm, suggesting that the Obama administration pulled a bait and switch on the American people when it came to what its health care bill was doing and not doing. Tim, thanks for your time today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
This is a stunning story. It confirms a lot of suspicions that people, I think, previously had, but it confirms it in a way that's now undeniable. You don't have to have an opinion about this. This is actually what happened. Why don't you lay out for us what you uncovered and the context of it for what it means?
Well, first, I want to make sure that I'm not trying to take credit for reporting here. It was Congressional Energy and Commerce Committee that got these emails, and they put them out there. But as you said, they didn't get a lot of attention. And the emails are sort of the back and forth between the drug lobby, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is the largest single industry lobby in the country. Their emails back and forth with both their members and with people in the White House and largely on the Senate staff of Senator Max Baucus. The negotiation sort of allowing the drug industry to so strongly shape and write parts of the healthcare bill. And then what I thought was most interesting was what I called sort of some of the professional wrestling there, where Obama would publicly throw a punch or even a pile driver at the drug industry, and then behind closed doors, everybody would be reassured that, no, we're still on the same page. We're still working hand-in-hand with the drug lobby to write this bill.
And that was the fear all along, that the president's rhetoric was populist in nature, we're taking on the drug companies, but where the rubber really hits the legislative road, it was almost the opposite. You recount some of these emails in which, for instance, one drug lobbyist, Bryant Hall, a former Democratic staffer, had an advance copy of President Obama's script in which the president, criticized the drug industry, emailed his colleagues in the drug industry the night before, saying background is that the president's words are harmless. He knows personally about our deal and is pushing no agenda. What deals were ultimately cut? Deals that don't live up to, and that's an understatement,
yep,
the rhetoric of President Obama about the drug industry.
Well, the heart of the deal, the sort of the main prongs of the deal, was that Obama was going to back off of some of his campaign promises, most notably allowing the reimportation of prescription drugs from Canada. Because in Canada, they're sold cheaper. We have laws to keep them out. People say, oh, well, that has to do about the safety of it. No, it's that they're cheaper in Canada because of Canadian price controls. And rather than, you know, the drug companies try to work something out with the Canadian government, they just get our government to say, no, you're not allowed to reimport. Obama had run saying, I'm going to stand up to the drug industry, allow reimportation, allow seniors to get cheaper drugs. And then the White House said, no, we're taking that off the table with the drug lobby, because the drug lobby is being cooperative in supporting this bill otherwise. Another main prong had to do with saving money for Medicare. Because when Republicans created the Medicare Prescription Drug Act in 2004, they had notably made sure that even though Medicare was buying bulk amounts of prescription drugs, that Medicare wasn't allowed to try to negotiate for a better deal. And Obama actually had a campaign ad where he attacked that deal and pointed out that one of the congressmen who had written that provision was Billy Tozan, who's the chairman of the Commerce Committee at the time. Tozan immediately left and became the top lobbyist for the drug industry. Well, guess who was in on these meetings cutting this deal with Barack Obama years later? It was drug lobbyist Billy Tozan.
That's right. One of the people who was, I think, if not one of the most frequent guests, the single most frequent guest in terms of lobbying at the White House. And there's this incredible email here between one of these top lobbyists, Brian Hall, at the pharmaceutical industry, writing, Billy Tozan and I were at the White House today, he's writing. We raised the issue, an issue about some of these questions of price, with Jim Messina. Messina, the deputy chief of staff, one of the drug industry's main points of contact, the former chief of staff to Max Baucus, the senator from Montana who's taken a huge amount of drug industry money. And the email goes on. Jim said that he went into the Oval Office and talked to the president. Messina reportedly asked Obama why his criticism of the drug industry was in the speech. Hall writes that Obama said, I was wondering the same thing, and he attributed it to a young speechwriter. Hall also wrote that White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel called the harsh words on the drug industry an error. So when you call it pro wrestling, it's the perfect metaphor, this kabuki theater pretending to be this big fight, when in fact everybody afterwards is slapping their backs and saying, great job, and everybody ultimately gets paid. That's how you lead your argument, your article. You said that the drug lobby in this case, it gets ensured that neither side actually gets hurt, both sides get paid, and everyone can be chums afterward. Why wasn't this part of the reporting at the time when this was all happening?
There was a little bit of it, but part of the problem, and I mean, I was doing, just to make sure all your listeners know, I come at this from a free market perspective, but a free market perspective that is very skeptical of industries like the drug industry and the health insurance industry that I think pervert the market. But setting that aside, I was writing at the time, and some other reporters were writing at the time, that this was turning into a giveaway to the drug industry, not just the provisions that I mentioned there, but just the fact that it's full of these subsidies for prescription drugs. It takes away some of your tax cuts for buying over-the-counter drugs while giving you more subsidies for buying more expensive drugs, including name brands instead of generics, all these things that don't help all our healthcare spending but do help the drug companies, even keeping generics off the shelf longer. All these deals were going to the drug industry, and at first I was just able to follow from the outside watching the progression of the bill. But then Billy Tozan sort of leaked out at the time some of the fact that he was sitting down with Rahm Emanuel in the West Wing of the White House, the drug lobbyist that Tozan was going into the Oval Office, and that he was cutting this deal. The White House started explicitly denying the existence of the deal. So at that point, all we had was he said, she said. Billy Tozan said, we had this meeting. Mm-hmm. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said that there is no such thing as a deal. But I think a lot of the media just sort of believed that Obama was going to fight the special interests, so they followed that narrative. And anything that went to a different narrative they just couldn't buy into that.
And it drove me crazy at the time. I remember talking to a friend of mine saying, you know, he keeps saying, President Obama keeps saying this bill takes on the drug industry, takes on the health insurance industry. Meanwhile, the drug industry, as you report in your story, was actually airing ads in support of the bill. And the health insurance industry, it aired some ads against the bill, but they were pretty weak. They certainly wasn't the campaign that was brought against Bill Clinton's proposal back in the 1990s. And to me, it always felt like, you know what, they're putting on a theater that looks like that they're fighting, but they're fighting in public to sort of placate their own, I guess, deceived bases, both sides deceived bases. And now these emails come out showing what was really going on. And I agree with you. Look, my criticism of the health care bill remains. I think it's a giveaway to the health insurance and drug companies. It's a big taxpayer bailout to the health insurance companies and the drug companies. There's certainly some provisions in there that I think are good news. But overall, the structure of the bill is that it's a giveaway, and that's why these emails show the pharmaceutical industry so happy about it. Tim Carney's piece, you can find it at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. Tim, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk to you. Coming up next, we'll see what you think. Did the Obama administration have to make a deal with the pharmaceutical industry to get the health care bill passed? Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Also coming up next, we're going to talk to actor and producer and director Adam McKay about Will Ferrell's new movie, The Campaign. Stick around.
Job creator, won't you? Job creator, won't you?
Tom Hartman Show. I'm David Sirota, filling in for Tom Hartman. You can find out more about me, David Sirota, at davidsirota.com. I want to get your quick take on what we just heard. We just heard about a release of emails showing that the White House was cutting a deal with the pharmaceutical industry to get rid of key provisions that President Obama had campaigned on, had promised, was giving speeches about in the health care bill, the part of the health care bill that was supposed to allow Medicare, for instance, to negotiate lower rates for prescription drugs purchased in bulk. That provision eliminated. The provision that would allow Americans to purchase lower-priced prescription drugs from places like Canada, that provision was taken out of the health care bill. As President Obama was campaigning publicly, he was saying he supported them, but then these emails come out showing that he was cutting a deal with the pharmaceutical industry to get rid of them at the same time. Is that a bait and switch, or is that just part of the legislative game? Is that part of the way that the legislative sausage is made? When you hear a story like this, that at the very moment President Obama was going out and telling you, hey, I'm going up against the drug companies, folks, that his chief of staff, his deputy chief of staff, his speechwriters were communicating with the drug industry, telling him, hey, nothing to worry here, nothing to worry about. Don't listen to the president. And the president himself in on this, saying, I don't know why this stuff was in my speech. I want the drug companies to know that I'm their friend. Do you feel duped? Do you feel tricked? Or do you feel like, hey, look, that's part of the game. That's part of the way legislation is made. He's got to do that. 866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM. I've worked for a lot of politicians. I've worked for Bernie Sanders. I've worked for David Obey, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, very powerful guy. I've worked for Governor Brian Schweitzer. And I haven't just volunteered for them, although volunteering is really important, not just on their campaigns. I've worked actually for them in the government. And I can only speak about my experience, but based on these emails, I have never in my experience did I experience something like that. And I'm thankful for that, because I think I would have been really unhappy about that. I'm somebody who's unhappy with overtly lying to people. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right to go out and tell people you're doing one thing and then tell other people, the most powerful people in the country, like pharmaceutical industry lobbyists, that you're going to do something else, that you're actually lying to people. I don't think that needs to be part of the political legislative game. It's not like the drug companies are so popular in America. It's not like the health insurance companies are so popular in America. However, they've got a huge amount of money. And the other side of the argument would be, well, if President Obama had really pushed a much more robust health care bill, one that really did take on the drug industry's profiteering, the drug industry would have spent him into the ground and would have waged a scorched earth campaign to not allow the bill to pass. So that in other words, this logic is that the only way to pass legislation is to make sure the legislation gives away the store to the richest and most powerful people, the richest and most powerful corporations, which of course are right at the center of the problem that's supposedly being solved. So where do you come down? When you hear these emails come out in which the White House was cutting a deal with the pharmaceutical industry to get rid of the toughest provisions in the health care bill, all while President Obama was coming out in public saying he was really fighting for those provisions, do you feel duped or do you feel like, hey, that's just the way the political system works? Let's go to the phone and see what you think. We'll go to Gus calling in from the Bronx. Gus, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I totally feel duped. I was very disappointed in the health care bill, the passage of it, but not only the end result of it, but even as it was going on, we were hearing that there was going to be no public option. We heard that they weren't going to put the negotiations on C-SPAN. So all along the way, you saw Obama cozying up to the industries and, and Rahm Emanuel cutting these deals. We heard whispers of it, and now we hear that it's exactly, what was suggested, and that, the American people kind of got cut out of this, and that they carved up the healthcare system.
Do you think, would you give any weight to the argument that this is just the way legislation is made in Washington, and you always have to make a deal, you always have to cut these kinds of deals?
Well, if I was the Obama administration now, I would say I was lying to them. I wasn't lying to you guys. But, we know what's going on. We know about pay for play. And, we've seen the result. I mean, Obamacare is in trouble now because it's unpopular from both the right and the left. And, it's not what Obama ran on in his own campaign. The defining difference between his campaign and Hillary's was that he wasn't going to have the individual mandate, and that's exactly what we ended up with.
Well, and the worst part is that there's that speech from Norfolk, Virginia. I wish I had the audio on me. I'll try to find it, where the president, well, the candidate Obama, is railing on secret deals with Washington lobbyists, with drug lobbyists. He actually explicitly says drug lobbyists, and he rails on this, and then, of course, that's exactly what the healthcare situation, the healthcare debate, ultimately became. And I'm with you. I think this was a major sleight of hand, and a calculated sleight of hand. When you got emails from the White House to drug lobbyists saying, oh, you don't have to worry about what the president's saying, boy, it just stinks, doesn't it? Gus, thanks for the call. Let's go to Laura in St. Paul, Minnesota. Laura, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hi. Listen, I agree with you. I think this stinks. I know I was furious at the time this legislation was passed because they gave away the store. But here's the deal. I don't think this is how legislation should be done. I don't think it's how it was intended, but it is how it is. And I think until Citizens United is overturned and money is taken out of the picture, this is the kind of crap we get.
Well, that's right. I mean, and here's the thing. Everybody needs to remember this. A lobbyist is as powerful as the money behind the industry that the lobbyist is lobbying for. The reason why the pharmaceutical industry gets its way in legislative fights is because politicians know that if they don't get their way, they're going to be spent into the ground. And that has been exacerbated, you're absolutely right, in the Citizens United era. Great point. Coming up next, the actor and director Adam McKay on the new movie, The Campaign.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Money in politics, as Laura reminds us, is very serious, but it can also be very funny. You're not going to want to miss this interview. Coming up next.
Revolution will not be televised, but it's live and kicking online. Forget Fox and the major networks. They're way behind the times.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm David Sirota, filling in for Tom Hartman. We've been talking a lot about money in politics, that story of emails between the White House and the drug industry, once again underscoring the effect of money in politics. And, of course, the story of the week in the political world, the Wisconsin election, in which everybody's trying to make different stories out of it. The story is you outspend your opponent by 8-1. Guess what? You're probably going to win. That's exactly what the Republican candidate in that recall election did. Scott Walker outspent his opponent by 7 or 8-1. and he ultimately won. Big shocker. Joining us now is somebody who has managed to do a very good job of using popular culture to inform and educate the country about many of these issues, and in a very entertaining and hilarious way. Actor, director, producer Adam McKay, most recently of Funny or Die. He's the producer on a new movie called The Campaign, a movie that features Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis. Adam McKay, it's good to talk to you as always.
Hey, David. How you doing, man?
All right, man. I'm doing well. So your movie, The Campaign, your latest movie, is so much about money, and it's so appropriate right now after this election in Wisconsin. Before we get to the storyline specifically of the movie, The Campaign, with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis, does the Wisconsin election kind of underscore to you the fact that money in politics is both disturbing and hilarious all at the same time, darkly hilarious at the same time?
It was, I mean, when Citizens United came through, I think all of us were talking about this is what would happen, and it's scary when predictions are this spot on. It was a worst case scenario, and that's just the little skirmish before the giant onslaught that's coming.
That's coming in the next couple of months. That's right, in the presidential race.
Oh man, money is going to just pour in. And the disturbing thing was, I had some arguments. I like to have discussions on my Facebook page with right wingers too, because I think it's people should talk even if they disagree. And a lot of them were downplaying it, trying to say that, oh, you think people are stupid because advertisements can change their minds. And I'm like, no, I think those people aren't stupid. I think we're all stupid because advertisements change all of our minds. They're that powerful. It's a $600 billion industry. And that really surprised me, is the amount of people that really think those ads, that people can't be fooled by them.
Well, which is insane, because, of course, companies are in the business of making money, and the reason companies buy ads is because they work. Right? It's kind of companies are maybe stupid in the short term, but over the long haul, they're not that stupid. And if they're spending money on advertising, if political candidates are spending money on advertising, if big donors who want certain politicians in office to make money for them are spending money on ads, they're not doing it just because it's a waste. Your new movie looks at this and I think plays to the idea that people understand how flooded with money the political system is, plays to this idea that most people who are going to go and see this movie are, the assumption is that we all understand how much money now plays a role in politics and we can at least laugh at it. Tell us a little bit about how you guys came up with this idea for this movie, and tell us the storyline.
Well, you know, we were just talking about the fact that we really wanted Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis to do a movie together. We all know each other. Zach's a great guy. We've been dying to work with him. And it was really when you started seeing the campaigns just jump to a new level of insanity. I always point to, it really was the I Am Not a Witch ad from, what was her name, Christine O'Donnell from Delaware, was one of just the singular most insane things I have ever seen in American politics, that if you wrote it as a joke, you'd go, that's too over the top. And we felt like suddenly you could do a political comedy that wasn't dry or satirical, that it could actually be raucous and insane and sort of the tradition of, you know, The Hangover or Old School. And that was the moment where we thought, you can do this now. Sadly, politics have gotten so out of bounds and so maniacal and crazed and career driven and saturated in money that you can actually do a slapstick comedy about politics and it won't play unrealistically.
And this is about a congressional race in North Carolina. If I'm not mistaken, Will Ferrell plays kind of a conservative Democrat. And although the parties aren't mentioned, it seems like Zach Galifianakis plays sort of a Tea Party guy recruited to beat him. And you've got Koch brother characters, and all mayhem ensues. I mean, I guess I would ask, and without having seen it yet, and it's not out yet, how far from reality did you have to stretch? Did you kind of feel like at certain times you would come up with something ridiculous, and then you'd hear something in the news that was even more ridiculous than what you have in the movie, and it was kind of like, truth is stranger than fiction?
I've never had this experience before. Dozens of times while we were shooting, things would happen, and we'd all get on the phone. The directors, Jay Roach, the writer Chris Henchy. I did some of the writing as well. I'm a producer on it. And Will and all of us would get on the phone. We had a scene where Cam Brady character, Will's character, is sort of lightly based on John Edwards. His wife breaks up with him during an interview with Piers Morgan on the air. And everyone was very concerned that that was so crazy that would never happen. And then during the Republican primary, Gingrich's ex-wife said he wanted an open marriage. And we all had to get on the phone and go, our scene now looks tepid. We have to juice this up. And it kept happening. There's lines in the movie that are just directly from the mouths of politicians. And I won't say what they are, but they're pretty obvious. And the crowd always gets them when they pop up. It's unbelievable the types of things we were hearing during the campaigns that kept overshadowing an already pretty crazy comedy in the script, and that made our movie look dry by comparison.
I mean, it's like politics has become a place where really no lines, there's not a line that, well, I'm sure there is a line, but it's going to be crossed, and it tends to get crossed, and that's the end of it. I would say this, I'm curious if you agree with me. It seems like John Edwards has created a bright line that you can, that Bill Clinton created the idea that you can have an affair, you can essentially have oral sex with an intern in the White House and still have a pretty decent, somehow preserve a pretty decent image. John Edwards crossed a line, and I think the outer line now is that you can't have an affair while running for president, while your wife is dying of cancer, and also not use protection and therefore impregnate somebody. I can't believe I'm trying to come up with a positive kind of takeaway from the John Edwards situation, but maybe the positive takeaway is finally there is some boundary that can't be crossed, and for a politician to then hope for redemption. Would you agree?
Here's how rough things are now. I think all these boundaries and lines are only put in place so we can then push them even further out. I bet you a cheesesteak that within the next 10 years, a politician is going to sleep around on his wife who's terminally ill, do everything that Edwards did, and get away with it.
And be either reelected or not have to resign I mean, I guess you're right. David Vitter, right? David Vitter, the Republican senator from Louisiana. I mean, he had issues with a brothel, and he not only stayed in office, he got reelected.
Well, Gingrich broke up with one of his ex-wives while she was sick in bed in the hospital. I believe she had cancer, and he went in and sat on the edge of the hospital bed and said, "This is over, honey." Like, he actually did that. That guy won some states in the last primary. That guy still has a thriving career. The big mistake that Edwards made is he made two mistakes. Number one, he hadn't done enough in his career. Mm-hmm. If he had some tangible accomplishments, like if he had, you know, balanced the deficit or been involved, that would have helped him. The other thing is that he was not a Republican, so he was vulnerable because he was actually talking about poverty, even though a lot of it, I think, was lip service.
Expand on that for
in those senses. He didn't have the big, big, big money behind him. He had big money, but he didn't have the big heavyweight money.
Now, this is an important point. So you're actually making the argument, and I know it's an argument that's made in the documentary Client 9 about Elliot Spitzer, that you would think, without thinking about money, that a politician who does sexual things that are not considered all that, you know, moral, that a politician who did that as a Republican in a party that preaches about family values would have a bigger problem being a Republican than a Democrat. Democrats typically don't sort of politicize family values so much. But you're actually saying that if you do the same kind of thing with sexual morals or immorality, but you are not backed by big money, if you're actually taking on big money, that's when you become vulnerable. That Elliot Spitzer, if Elliot Spitzer was a Republican who had done what he did as a Republican backing big money, that he probably could still be in office. That, in fact, there's a nexus between money and how ultimately the political system, whether the political system tolerates what it considers immoral sexual behavior. Is that what you're saying?
I say there's no question about it. I mean, Elliot Spitzer's mistake was twofold. Number one, he went after the biggest money there is, Wall Street. And he did it with an extra little twist of the knife. He was very, you know, some people say he was kind of a jerk about it. And you see in that documentary, Client 9, the guy from the one bank says on camera, "I hired a private detective. I went after him. Elliot Spitzer isn't going to do this to me." I mean, it's not, we're not speculating here. That's exactly what happened. Now, the only time they seem to mess up is when you're so caught in the crosshairs, like the preacher of the mega church from Colorado who turned out to be getting male prostitutes. Mm-hmm. where, and that wasn't a guy who was directly tied to big money. He's sort of part of the distraction machine. But occasionally they'll get caught so naked and so red-handed and that you'll see them kind of step away. But most of the time, absolutely. Oh, there's no question. If you have big, giant money behind you, you can do a lot of stuff. I mean,
and if you don't, it's even more incumbent on you to be as clean as a whistle as possible. And I think that is something that doesn't get discussed very much. We just remember, oh, Elliot Spitzer, the sex scandal. David Vitter, we don't remember the sex scandal. But the whole point is just a reiteration of the fact that money colors absolutely everything in politics. And that's what, of course, the movie The Campaign is all about. Adam McKay, the actor, director, the writer, the founder of Funny or Die with Will Ferrell. He's the producer on the new movie, The Campaign. It's always good to talk to you, man. Thanks for taking the time today.
Great to talk to you too, David. Have a good one.
All right, stay in touch. Coming up next, we'll take your calls, and I'm going to tell you about my upcoming newspaper column. Why is the Senate investigating those who leaked information about the president's so-called kill list and not investigating the legality of the kill list itself? Stick around for that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You shoot the messenger. When you wage a war on whistleblowers, it means you're trying to cover something up. Inside That Story, coming up in a few minutes.
What a crying shame, a crying shame, what we became.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm David Sirota, filling in for Tom Hartman. You can find out more about me, davidsirota.com. We're at my radio station's website, sirota.am760.net. I'm the morning host on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk, broadcasting to you from the beautiful city of Denver and the beautiful state of Colorado. Every day I look out my studio's window looking at the mountains out there, realize how lucky I am to live out here. It's such a great place. And if you want to find out more about me, find it out on the website. I'm a syndicated newspaper columnist, also contributing writer to Salon.com. We're going to be talking to a colleague of mine, Jefferson Morley, on the other side of the next break about the drone war. And I want to preview for you a column that I have coming out in newspapers across the country tomorrow. Something that's been on my mind since the revelations of President Obama's kill list. When a democracy functions properly, media revelations of executive branch misconduct are supposed to result in some kind of investigation by the legislative branch. Watergate epitomized the dynamic. Illegal acts exposed by the Washington Post prompted congressional hearings, ultimately prosecutions. In other words, checks and balances function properly. The system cleans itself out of wrongdoers, and at that point rejected the Nixonian notion that no matter what a president does, it is inherently legal. Remember that idea that whenever a president does anything, it's legal? Remember this quote?
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
After Watergate, we were supposed to have rejected that. In fact, the Watergate investigation and prosecutions and resignations were a rejection of that, and thankfully so. So when the New York Times this week ran the headline, Senate will investigate national security leaks about terrorism kill list, it was a frightening sign that something has gone horribly wrong since the Woodward and Bernstein era. A little bit of background. Last week, the Times published that expose detailing how President Obama personally orders the execution of American citizens and foreigners that he labels terrorists. According to the Times, the program deems all military-aged males in a drone strike zone as combatants worthy of death. It allows the president to be judge, jury, and executioner and operates wholly outside of any law in the United States. The Times reports that the administration justifies this kind of power by insisting somehow that the Fifth Amendment's guarantee of due process can now, quote, be satisfied by internal deliberations wholly within the executive branch. Of course, the memo laying out this preposterous and radical legal theory is completely secret and hasn't been ratified, of course, by any court. In terms of size, scope, and long-term effects, this kill list program makes the Watergate scandal look altogether quaint. You would therefore think that at a minimum, even the most flaccid rubber stamp Congress might ask a few questions about the president's kill list and the dangerous precedents it sets. But of course, you would be wrong. As the Times noted in that subsequent follow-up story, Congress is focused not on shutting down or even overseeing the assassination program. It's instead focused on making sure those who blew the whistle on it are punished. Why? Because that's going to ensure that other such unauthorized programs can continue. If you think that description of motive is overwrought hyperbole, think again. Senator John McCain made clear that he wants revelations of illegal activity halted and prosecuted specifically because, quote, such disclosures can only undermine similar ongoing or future operations. This is part of a broader campaign against those who are courageously exposing illegality. As former Foreign Service Officer Peter Van Buren reports, the federal government now targeting whistleblowers for recrimination, with, quote, the number of cases against whistleblowers suggesting an organized strategy to deprive Americans of knowledge of the more disreputable things that their government does. That's right. Rather than celebrating the heroes who expose wrongdoing and then stopping the illegal acts, the government is shooting the messengers in order to let the crimes continue. If you're an Obama partisan who insists that the crackdown right now on whistleblowers is somehow appropriate because your guy is in power, your favored politician is in power, take heed of the president's own warning. As he said just a few years ago in his first year as president, allowing any executive to ignore the Constitution is problematic because, quote, you never know who's going to be president 4 years from now. You also never know what other executive might make the same moves in your own hometown. After all, if a president is arguing that indictments, juries, and trials aren't necessary to execute somebody, it's not hard to imagine a governor or a mayor arguing the same thing when merely locking people up. That's why the war on whistleblowers is not just some theoretical problem only for academics to debate or foreigners to worry about. It represents a genuine domestic threat to democracy itself, one that we have not seen ever before. If through silence and complacency, if through partisanship and political games, if through apologism for your favorite politician, we allow that threat to democracy to expand, none of us should be surprised when more of us end up in the government's crosshairs. This is a hugely important issue. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I don't care if you love Barack Obama or can't stand Barack Obama. The notion of a nation sitting by and allowing a president to execute American citizens without even charging them with a crime, it is an insult to the history of this country. It is an insult to everybody who has put their lives on the line for the Constitution. It is offensive and it is disturbing. The things that set us apart from so many other countries are being whittled away. And one of the things that set us apart from so many other countries, in a good sense, was the idea that we were a nation with the rule of law, where the rule of law was supreme. We don't have kings. We don't have dictators. And when we all sit by and say, well, Obama's a Democrat, he's a good guy, so his kill list is cool, no problem, nothing to worry about here. When we do that, we ignore the president's own warning. You never know who's going to be president 4 years from now, and you never know what kinds of precedents you are setting. Speaking of all this, how far has the drone war gone? Coming up next, one of the experts covering that story after these words.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to the Tom Hartman Program, but alas, I am not Tom Hartman. I'm David Sirota. The voices are different. I'm a little bit younger, probably a little bit less intelligent than Tom Hartman, who is probably one of the most intelligent people in the world. Hopefully I'm holding the fort down for you here on his show. It's always an honor to be asked to fill in for Tom Hartman. We've been having a busy couple of hours here on this program, and it's going to get even busier. We just were talking about the kill list, the president's kill list, revelations that the president is conducting a secret drone war in which he chooses personally who lives and who dies. How intense is that drone war becoming? What does that drone war really mean? And should we be compensating the victims, the civilian victims, who are killed in that drone war? Joining us now is Salon.com's Jefferson Morley, who has been covering the rise of the drone war, the rise of drone technology. And his latest piece at Salon.com is about the United Nations calling for an investigation into drone warfare and potentially calling for the United States to compensate the civilian victims of drone warfare. Jefferson Morley, thanks for your time today.
Hi, thank you, David.
Let's start with the United Nations. The revelations in the New York Times about who was being killed in the drone war suggest, and not just suggest, state explicitly that the United States government is juking the numbers, saying we have a perfectly accurate rate of killing, quote-unquote, combatants and militants, because basically what we do is we say that any military-aged male in a drone strike zone is essentially worthy of death, is a military
yeah.
casualty, not a civilian. Does that juke the statistics? Does that make it harder for us to figure out how many civilians were actually killing when officials are saying that they basically, after the fact, count corpses?
It certainly does. And it says even more than that. It says that we're really not interested in distinguishing who might have been killed. A lot of, you know, the independent monitoring groups like New America Foundation here in Washington and the Bureau for Investigative Journalism in London, who monitor these things carefully, report that there is a very large number of civilians who are killed. New America Foundation estimates between 11 and 17% of the people killed over the last 8 years have been civilians. Bureau of Investigative Journalism says up to 175 children in the same period. And when the Obama administration says that is their criteria for deciding who's a civilian, I think they're trying to drive that number down as a way of justifying the program. But I think that is also why you had the UN Human Rights Commissioner coming out today and saying, calling for an investigation of the drone strike program. The UN has always couched its questioning of the drone strikes in terms of transparency and accountability. And with the Times story, I think we know a lot more now about how the war is run and how closely controlled it is. And so I think as we learn more, I think it's unsurprising that UN officials are stepping up their criticism of it. We know
the Obama administration's justification says that the reason they classify any military-aged male within any drone strike zone anywhere, whether we know anything about them or not, as a combatant or a militant, is because if you are anywhere near somebody who the president accuses of being a terrorist, it must mean you are up to no good. Now, this echoes, and it's frightening, it echoes literally word for, and those are the word for word ways that the New York Times reported this after talking to administration sources, and it echoes word for word, of course, the rationale that George Zimmerman used in pursuing Trayvon Martin, that somebody doing in a certain place just by virtue of being there must be up to no good. How should we think about that argument? I mean, does the administration possibly have a point that if you happen to be in a drone strike zone, it must mean by definition that you know the bad guy who's there and you're helping the bad guy? Is that a fair way to think about it or not?
No, I don't think it's a fair way. First of all, they are attacking a lot of these attacks have common features, and one very common attack is to strike a house at late at night. When you know that everybody there is going to be asleep, and when you know that family members are going to be around, women and children who could not possibly have any involvement or responsibility in any alleged attacks that the men are planning. So I think that the administration is trying to insulate itself from criticism about civilian casualties by defining them out of existence. It's like what the Bush administration did around torture. They just said, well, waterboarding's not tortured, therefore that person wasn't tortured. therefore we're not torturing anyone. It's not really a very convincing argument, and to me, it's very the similarity between the justifications of Obama killing suspected militants and Bush torturing suspected militants. The rationale is almost exactly the same.
What about this notion that ABC News' Jake Tapper tried to ask the White House about, and he kind of got blocked when he was asked this question? They kind of circumvented the question. He asked the question about drone technology, which you've covered extensively for Salon.com. And again, online with us, Jefferson Morley of Salon.com. This question of, well, if we're waging a drone war now, drone technology isn't all that advanced technology. I mean, we certainly have the Cadillac of drones, or the Ferrari of drones, but drone technology as a whole is not that complicated a set of technologies. It's not like a nuclear weapon. What's going to happen when China or Russia gets a hold of this technology? Should we be worried, and not just China or Russia, what about a terrorist group? I mean, how easily would it be for a country that, let's say, we don't want to have armed drones, or an organization like Al-Qaeda that we don't want to have drones, to get those drones? Easy, hard, somewhere in between?
Increasingly easy. First of all, if you look at the number of countries that have drones, there's probably about 30 that have them and 40 that are, maybe 10 more that have expressed an interest and are taking steps. So there's lots of countries that have this technology. There's also non-state actors who had this. During the 2007 war between Hezbollah and Israel, Iran gave Hezbollah an armed drone to use. So it's also, it doesn't have to be in the hands of a state. There is an example. A man was arrested last September, a graduate student from Boston, who was planning to use a drone to attack the Pentagon and the Capitol here in Washington. Now, I'm not saying, there's always questions of entrapment around those types of prosecution that hasn't come to trial yet, but technologically, this individual was charged with obtaining a drone, and that was the easy part of what he was doing. The harder part was to find a weapon to put on it. The setting of a precedent around the use of this, I think, is also very worrisome, because there's not going to be any saying, oh, well, you can't do it when we can. Other countries are going to do this, and I think they're going to take the precedent of saying, well, we were just trying to preempt an attack on ourselves, mm-hmm. just like mm-hmm. you were. So
that's what's so scary.
We can hear a lot about that.
It is what is so absolutely scary. On top of all the civilian casualties that we're creating right now, is the idea that at some point in our lifetimes, in the very near future, it's not just going to be Americans that have drones with Hellfire missiles. It's going to be other countries and possibly other organizations, and we will have set the precedent of how to use them. And the precedents we set today will have very real ramifications for us and for the rest of the world, I think, for the future. Jefferson Morley is with Salon.com. He's been aggressively covering the rise of drone warfare. Jefferson, keep up the great work. Really, your work is absolutely terrific. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, David.
Coming up next, we'll see what you think. Do you think prosecuting the drone war is the right thing to do? Do you think the president should have the power to decide who lives and who dies? Or do you worry about blowback? Is a worry about other countries using drones on us a fair concern? Stick around. We'll see what you think.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM. If you want to weigh in on the rise of the drone war, we'll see what you think coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by SolarWorld. SolarWorld.com for information on solar electricity.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm David Sirota, broadcasting to you from Denver, Colorado. We're talking about the drone war, revelations about President Obama's drone war. 27 civilians killed over the weekend in Pakistan at the hands of the drone war, although it's not sure that the government would count it that way. Any military-aged male who's killed in any drone strike anywhere in the world is now counted as a militant, a combatant worthy of death by the U.S. government. It's kind of reminiscent of the Vietnam War, counting the corpses and calling them militants after the fact, whether they were or were not. Are we making ourselves safer with the drone war? Should we applaud the drone war? Do you think the drone war is going well? Or do you think Congress should be investigating not who's leaking details about the drone war, as John McCain has suggested, but instead investigate whether the president has the legal authority to decide which American citizens live and which American citizens die. Let's go to the phones, see what you think. And I just want to say before we go to the phones very quickly, and the number 866-987-TOM, got a couple of emails and Twitter posts saying, thanks for your comments, Sirota, about the drone war, but now is not the time to talk about it because we're 6 months away from an election and all we need right now is support of one candidate. I see it exactly the opposite. Because we're close to an election, it's an especially good time to be talking about major issues. An election is an exercise in democracy. Saying an exercise in democracy is a reason to suppress democracy and not talk about major issues in front of our democracy is, there are so many contradictions in that, I don't even know where to start. Elections are times when politicians are supposed to answer to the people and supposed to make promises about what they're going to do. Stripping that of all discussion about policy that's going on right now, especially policies of life and death, because you want your candidate to succeed, is abrogating your responsibilities as a citizen in a democracy. And I, for one, am not going to be part of that. Let's go to the phone, see what you think about the drone war. We will start with Samuel, calling in from Sonoma, California. Samuel, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hello. I would like to offer a different take. Now, I view Al-Qaeda as basically recruits for the U.S. Imperial Army, kind of like the French Foreign Legion of the old days, and that when somebody deserts from your Imperial Army, you have battlefield executions. It has a long history, and I'm sure that's how they justify it in the White House, that they're just killing some of their rogue agents.
So are you going back to all the way back to the war in Afghanistan with the Russians and how the United States armed the Mujahideen who ultimately became Al-Qaeda and that Al-Qaeda is basically a rogue spin-off of a Mujahideen that we armed and we're just basically eliminating the threat that the rogue agents that we created are now posing to the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's what you're doing. The question is what do you do when you create monsters? Prescott Bush helped Hitler come to power. What do you do when certain right-wing political types create monsters in foreign countries?
Well, the problem is that with the drone war, if you believe the statistics, somewhere between 17 and 30% of people we kill in the drone war are civilians. And you have to believe that for every civilian who's killed, and additionally, every accused terrorist that's killed, probably creates more terrorists among family members, friends, and the community that you've thus terrorized. I mean, the drone war is terrorizing the population of Pakistan. Now, maybe you're somebody who says, well, the population of Pakistan should be terrorized because that population has, in some places, harbored terrorists. But the point is, without even making a moral comment about the justifying the killing of civilians, national security-wise, if you have a ratio where for every accused terrorist that you kill, you end up creating 20 terrorists or 20 terrorist sympathizers 20 years down the road from people who don't like that their families' lives were just extinguished. Are you really making yourself safer? I'm not so sure. And that's what's so scary. Frankly, for the long haul, when I look at my son, I have an 18-month-old son, and I think about the world for him, a world of climate change where the catastrophic effects of climate change are going to affect him a lot more than they're going to affect me, where the decisions by administrations right now to create more terrorists and more hatred out there are going to affect him a lot for a lot longer, God willing, than they'll affect me. Hopefully he lives a long life. This is about the future. And I actually think this goes to a narcissism, a selfishness in the American culture, which says, well, listen, if we're making ourselves safer right now for the next year or two, that's fine, even if we're making the next generation way less safe. You see that in our environmental policy and our terrorism policy, this lack of regard for whether we're actually endangering, potentially, the next generation. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Azra, calling in from Oak Brook, Illinois. Azra, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I was questioning this drone attacks. A lot of innocent civilians get killed every time the whole villages get terrorized, and we can just sit back and say, oh, because we are not having any casualties, so we don't have to worry about political consequences. But how about those families over there, the mothers, mm-hmm. the children that are widowed and orphaned? After all, don't they deserve the respect for humanity?
Well, you'd think so. And here's how to think about the double standard here. And I asked this question on my local radio show, my morning show. I said, if let's say there's a 20% kill rate, between 17 and 30%, let's call it 20% of civilians in the drone war. Now, police departments are starting to use drone technology in cities. Some police departments are even arming their drones. Do you think the American population would tolerate, let's say, a major city's police department using a drone that had only an 80% accuracy rate with killing or injuring? No way. Americans would be absolutely up in arms if a drone, a police department's drone, flew over a city, tried to put down a riot, killed, I don't know, 10 legitimate rioters, and then killed 2 or 3 kids. I mean, that would be a national scandal. But we tolerate it. We're tolerating that kind of thing every single day because it's non-Americans. How sad and how telling. Coming up next, our last topic of the day, should soda be classified as a food? And can you liken soda to heroin? I know, those are pretty provocative questions. Stick around, we'll tell you why I'm asking them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're going to talk about that question with the esteemed New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman, who says we should be thinking about soda in exactly that way. Stick around.
And we'll all float on the cake.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I want to close out the show with a discussion about what is and what is not a food. I know that sounds like a crazy question, right? I mean, a food, you know it when you see it. Not exactly, according to Mark Bittman, the New York Times food columnist. He joins us now to discuss his most recent column, which looks at the question of what a food is and what a food is not, after New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg moved to ban sugary drinks in his city from being sold in containers larger than 16 ounces. And this question of what a food is, I think, is it's really a profound question when you actually take a second to think about it. Mark Bittman, of course, is the author of the Food Matters Cookbook, How to Cook Everything, How to Cook, and a number of other books. You can find more about him, markbittman.com. That's markbittman.com. I am a devotee of his columns and his writing. Mark, thanks for your time today.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Dave.
The definition of a food, I threw that out there. I guarantee you some listeners are like, what are you guys talking about? I know exactly what a food is. Why ask this question? I mean, that's the headline of your column. What do you mean by what is a food?
Well, you know, to me, I became curious about this. I've been thinking about this, soda accounts for 7% of our calories in the United States, and it's implicated to a huge extent in the obesity crisis, which no one except for the soda industry disputes any of that. And Mayor Bloomberg a year or so ago tried to make it, and other people around the country have done this too, tried to make it so that SNAP, which is what we now call food stamps, so that SNAP could not be used to buy soda. And the USDA shot that down for a variety of pretty lame reasons, but that's sort of besides the point. But I started to think about, when food stamps were first conceived, they excluded non-food items, and that was tobacco and alcohol and chewing gum, for example, are all excluded from food stamps. But soda, although it's this old senator whose name is slipping my mind now, but anyway, one of the architects of food stamps said he didn't think that, he specifically named Coke, but he said Coke and its family of beverages, this was back in the 60s, should be excluded from food stamps because these are supposed to be, the idea of food stamps was to nourish people who couldn't afford to nourish themselves. So that was a very good argument, I thought, but he was shot down because the beverage lobby just beat him to death. So I just asked myself, what is food? And I looked it up in the dictionary one day, and the dictionary, which I was using, said that it's a nutritious substance that people or animals eat or drink in order to maintain life and growth. And that's a pretty good definition, but then I looked up nutritious just to be, you know, okay with really feeling like I understood what this was. And nutritious food is food that provides those substances necessary for growth, health, and good condition. Well, by that definition, soda is not food. I mean, it does provide growth, but exactly in the way that we don't want it. And as far as health and good condition, it doesn't do that either. And this is true of almost every food that contains high levels of added sugar and nothing else. I mean, the reason soda is the most egregious example is that it is basically carbonated water with sugar in it and some artificial flavoring. So, I mean, Gatorade is similar, Snapple is similar, so on down the line. These are things with no calories except calories that come from sugar and no nutrients whatsoever except sometimes they throw in some chemicals. So it's not food, and it is a food stamps issue, and a food stamps issue is huge because 50 million Americans are now on SNAP, so it's a minority, but it's a really, really big minority. But it's an issue for everybody because we all subsidize in one way or another. We all subsidize the sugar industry. We all subsidize the beverage industry, and we all subsidize health care, which is a growing cost, eternally growing, it seems, but one that's growing at a very rapid rate and where the costs of obesity-related diseases are now around $150 billion a year and predicted to grow to $1 trillion a year within 20 years if current trends continue. So long answer to a short question,
Do we need to start thinking about sugar as in the same kind of way that we think about a drug? I want to read a clip from your piece here. You say if the mayor Bloomberg were to ban 32 ounce mugs of beer at Yankee Stadium after a number of DUI arrests, and indeed there are limits to drinking at ballparks, we would not be hearing about the so-called nanny state from conservatives in the wake of his announcement. You write here that sugar sweetened beverages don't meet the description of real food any more than do beer and tobacco, and for that matter, heroin. And they have more in common with these things than they do with carrots. I mean, are we at the point where we need to think about it as a drug?
I did write that. I do believe that. It's funny because beer contains more nutrients.
I was going to say that as a beer defender. I was just going to say that.
You know, beer comes closer to qualifying as food than soda did, and certainly in the pre-industrial times, you know, alcoholic beverages were a form of preserving the harvest, just like cheese or other fermented products, and people used beer as a means of getting quick calories in an easy way. And in those days, you needed that because you were really working hard. That's sort of besides the point. It's a stretch to compare soda to heroin, obviously, but it is useless. There's a lot of evidence, the increasing evidence that most junk food, but especially junk food that's very, very high in sugar, is addictive or at least habit forming. And if people want to read more about this, or if you want to talk to this guy sometime because he's great and very amusing, the person who's done the most research on that is a guy named Rob Lustig, Lustig. Mm-hmm. And he's big into this, saying that sugar is basically addictive and it is destructive. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, people in this world, people like me who wrote about these kind of issues, would refer to soda as something that contains empty calories. But empty, you know, water contains no calories. But empty sort of implies harmless. And soda, and again, I want to stress that it's not, you know, soda is a shortcut word for what are officially now called sugar-sweetened beverages. So you're talking about Gatorade and Snapple and Red Bull and all those kinds of things, in addition to, obviously, traditional sodas like Coke and 7-Up and Pepsi and that stuff. The point is that those calories are not empty. They're harmful. They're causing obesity, and obesity is directly causes diabetes, and diabetes is deadly, and it can't be cured. It can be treated, but it can't be cured, and it can only be treated at great expense, and we all bear that expense. And in a way, the parallels. This has become a public health issue, like wearing seatbelts or wearing motorcycle helmets or stopping for red lights or anything else that kind of makes sense. As a society, we agree there are some costs we don't want to bear together, and we try to avoid those costs. That's why we put stoplights in intersections, because we don't want to pay for, you know, 20 accidents at each intersection a day. So this is a similar thing in a way. It is a big public health issue. And I actually think, you know, Bloomberg's minor, it's really a minor move to limit the size of fountain beverages that you can get at food service establishments. It's not going to make a huge difference, but what it's going to start to do, and I said some of this stuff in my blog post that was associated with the column, but what it's going to start to do is it's going to say to kids, these things are bad, and it's going to start to demonize them in the way that we demonized cigarettes. And that's what gets things going, is when six-year-olds think, huh, there's something wrong with this stuff. Maybe I don't want to become the kind of person who consumes it. You know.
And that was the most powerful part, of, in my estimation, of your column, your recent column. And you can find it at the New York Times website, where you write, right now, a tall 5-year-old with a dollar can approach a machine and buy a fizzy beverage equivalent to a cup of coffee with 9 teaspoons of sugar in it, and that's a mere 12 ounces. Holding the line at that seems to make some sense, unless you somehow define harmful non-food substances as something other than bad. We only have about 2 minutes left here, but I want you to answer the question, which I'm sure you've gotten before. What about the argument that says, look, if I want to drink a bucket of soda, and I want to become 500 pounds drinking a bucket of soda every single day, that's up to me. That's my I should have the freedom to do that.
Well, and you do, but I think that we as a society should agree that as we have with many other things, you have the right to smoke cigarettes 18 packs a day if you like. I think that we as a society need to say, this is stuff that's recognized as being dangerous, harmful, and costly from both a health perspective and an economic perspective, and therefore we're going to disincentivize it. We're going to make it so that you have to think twice about it. It's going to cost more money. It's going to be more difficult to find. You're not going to be able to buy it until you're 12 or 16 or 18 without parental supervision, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are things we've done before with other substances. Soda is next on the list. And, Dave, I'm telling you, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, we're going to look back and say, this was so obvious. It's good that we did this stuff. We should have done it sooner.
I completely agree. And you're one of the people who's making that case. And I think we'll look back, frankly, on your work and say, thank God there were people like you raising the red flag. Mark Bittman is the author of the Food Matters Cookbook, among other books. Find his website, markbittman.com, and on the New York Times, find his work there. Mark, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Coming up next, we'll get your quick take. You can call us. Tell us if you think sugar should be likened to heroin, if we should think of sugar as a drug. Stick around. David Sirota finishing up guest hosting for Tom Hartman. You can find out more about me, davidsirota.com, or at my AM 760 morning radio show webpage, sirota.am760.net. Let's go to the phones on the question raised by Mark Bittman, the New York Times food columnist. Is sugar a drug? Is soda really a food? Can you really call soda a food? And should sugar be regulated like a drug and not just like a food? We're talking about this, of course, in the wake of Mayor Michael Bloomberg moving to say to ban sugary soft drinks from being sold in containers larger than 16 ounces. He's basically saying we should regulate sugar essentially like a drug. Do you agree or disagree? Is that the way we should look at sugar in the modern parlance? Let's go to the phones. We will go to Joe calling in from West Virginia. Joe, you're on the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, I'd like to say yes. I believe we should regulate sugar, because the difference between sugar and high fructose corn syrup is sugar makes the body think that it's still thirsty. So that way, you constantly have to keep drinking. It's the same with heroin. You never get that same high from the first hit.
And you know, this, I was reading some science about this, and the scientists are still mystified as to why physiologically when you drink a soda, you don't, when you eat the requisite, the same amount of sugar as in a soda in another food, your body sends signals to your brain, hey, I'm full, I don't want any more of this stuff, or at least an impulse that maybe I don't want any more of this. Something about the way sugar is designed doesn't trigger that same response in the human body. And scientists, public scientists, are mystified by it. Now, I have a suspicion, and it's just a suspicion, that scientists at the food, at the beverage companies themselves, they probably know why this is. But in terms of university scientists, they don't know why this is, and that's why it's so dangerous. You drink a soda, you don't feel as correspondingly full as you would if you ate the same amount of sugar in a different substance. It's pretty freaky. It is absolutely freaky, and to your point, it does kind of resemble a stealth drug when you talk about it that way. Joe, thanks for the call. Let's go to Andrew, calling in from Minneapolis. Andrew, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show. I totally agree, and I think, you know, when the corporations are using sugar on us and they're addicting us to it, just like people get addicted to all kinds of drugs, it should be regulated. I mean, that's, you know, if they're going to addict us to it, then it would be just like any, you know, any over-the-counter drug that could be addicted to. You know, it should be regulated in the same way when they're using it to get people hooked.
Now, here's the problem. Here's the problem with regulating it, and I think a lot of FDA folks would probably say it will be trickier than other drugs because sugar is a naturally occurring substance. I mean, there's sugar in an apple, and
right.
And I think we need to start having a conversation about okay, how do you differentiate for purposes of regulation? Differentiate between a can of soda and an apple, because you better believe the beverage industry lobbyists are going to say, listen, there's sugar in an apple, there's sugar in a pear.
Oh yeah, and I think that you could start by doing it by saying, you know, the added sugar, things that are added to a beverage or a food to make it sweeter,
mm-hmm.
versus the sugar that's already in a fruit or an apple.
Infusing something with sugar, processing it to really supercharge it with sugar. That's a start. That's exactly right. Andrew, thanks for the call. Let's go to Scott, calling in from Atlanta, Georgia. Scott, you're on the Tom Hartman program. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, man.
Hey, I was just calling because I don't agree. That you had a caller that called in and said sugar is equivalent to heroin, and that's just not factually correct. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to try to overregulate every single thing. People have to start taking some accountability, and when does it end? You know, what's next? Peanut butter? Now I'm going to regulate peanut butter because 0.1% of the population has a peanut allergy, but now we're going to regulate that too.
Well, I agree with you that we need to decide where the boundaries are. I think you're right, and that's part of the conversation. And I think that Mark Bittman, when he wrote that, he wrote it to make a point. I don't think he was literally saying that sugar is the same thing as heroin, but I would throw it back to you, Scott. Your argument is the argument against every kind of regulation that we've had that I think most Americans, vast majority of Americans now support.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have arsenic and applesauce or anything like that. But when does it end? I mean, Bloomberg wants to regulate, you know, the size of the soda you're walking around with. It's like, come on.
Yeah, but I would say to you the same. I would say to you the same thing. I know it doesn't seem, because of the culture we live in, very sugary substances seem like food. But if you actually talk to scientists about what this is doing to public health, I don't think it's a stretch to say, hey, listen, there were other times there was an era. If you get in the flux capacitor, in the DeLorean with me, fire up the flux capacitor, we're going to go back 50 years. 50 years ago, scientists were, the tobacco companies were airing commercials saying that smoking was healthy. And people were saying, oh, well, if we regulate cigarettes, where does it end? Are you going to start regulating? Are you going to start regulating peanut butter? My point here is that I think you have a point. I think that we need to have the discussion to decide where the boundaries are. But don't allow your argument. I encourage you. Don't allow your concerns about the slippery slope to say that there we can't find a good and decent middle ground. I would agree with you that Mayor Bloomberg saying you can't buy more than a 16-ounce cup of soda at one time. You can buy two of them if you want. I would agree that that's not a solution. It's not going to fix the problem. The problem is that he's a mayor And look, I'm no huge fan of Michael Bloomberg, but he's a mayor. He can't change the entire industrial agriculture system that has you and I as taxpayers subsidizing the ingredients that go into that, to those sugary products. So he's trying to do what he can. I'm just saying, while conceding your point, don't let your concern about the slippery slope make you conclude that we can't find an appropriate middle ground. We found an appropriate middle ground when it came to seatbelts, when it came to cigarettes, when it came to all sorts of other regulations. I think with sugar, it's a little bit jarring because we're so used to being surrounded by sugar. But I think with sugar, we can say, listen, let's have the discussion. I mean, that would be a big step forward. That's the benefit of what Bloomberg did. At least we're talking about it. Hey, man, thanks for the call. That's the show. I'm David Sirota. If you want to find out more about me, davidsirota.com. I want to thank you all for letting me fill in for Tom Hartman. See you next time.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.